Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Before he became a writer of fiction, Chico author Phil Knutson wrote for the timber industry to help landowners understand their options and make sensible management decisions. His forest management plan was readable, yet technically accurate. Phil Knutson had studied natural sciences, gotten a B.S. in forestry and one in botany, and he spent his professional life in the forest of Wisconsin and Michigan. It's no surprise that Phil Knutson loves the people and the trees of Chico. Today I'm going to ask him about his novel Speed Trap Murders, Margot's Manic Dream, and he wrote this under the name P.G. Knutson. Phil Knutson, welcome.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Now, your last name is a little unusual. You do pronounce it Knutson.
Yes, we do.
Okay. Now, the first thing I noticed was the cover of your book, but I just thought, as I started reading it, where in the world did you get this idea, Phil?
Well, it's probably out of the artistic nature in my brain. There is reference to the strawberry moon in the story.
Yes, but not until chapter 71. So I happened to pick up your book on the day of the blood moon right here in Chico. Huh. And so I looked at the cover of your book and I thought, oh, what's the blood moon doing on the cover of his book? Of course, when I got to chapter 71, I saw, oh, this is the strawberry moon.
It all adds up.
Well, why is it called a strawberry moon?
It's because every month there's a different name for the full moon. And the strawberry moon occurs in June. And it has a pinkish or reddish glow to it.
Well, I was curious to know because you, in chapter 71, you say strawberry moon, June 4th, 1993. So out of curiosity, I looked up to see if there was a strawberry moon on June 4th, 1993. And sure enough, there was. And you tell us that these dates in your book are accurate dates.
They're accurate and they're very important to the story. Of course, it is a historical reference point. Each place I show a date, and you'll notice when you're reading the book, there are things that happened during 1992 that many of us may not remember exactly.
Oh, some of us do.
But some of us do, that's right.
Because your character is obviously a fictional. This is a work of fiction. It's a mystery. And so the characters are fictional, but you say the dates are accurate.
Well, yes, they are.
Our first mystery that we encounter is this moon on the cover. Why? What does this moon, how does this play in the story? But we have to wait to chapter 71. So I'm going to ask you to read the prologue of your book. And I do like the fact that you give us a date and you also give us where this is taking place. This prologue is called A Wayward Child. And you tell us the date, and you say Burntwood Prairie, Minnesota. Is there such a place as Burntwood Prairie, Minnesota?
I hope not, because that came out of the backside of my brain somewhere.
Okay. Well, would you read us that prologue, please?
Yes, I can do that. It seems that no one understands Margot Toroff. Never did. Gone for years, but here she is, back again, seeking a tranquil life. She turns at her parents' mailbox, then breaks at the entrance to the two-track driveway, her last chance to change her mind and turn around. The old farmhouse looks quiet, and the lights are all on, just like always. What am I doing here, she says. Another mistake I'll regret for the rest of my life? With a forlorn love for her parents, yet with mounting apprehension, she slowly drives up to the house, imagining a round of shouting that was bound to come. Dad will kick me out, she mutters, remembering her last threatening words that she'd never come back. She forgets. Has it been 10 years? 8? And what was Dad's prediction? Something about seeding wild oats? Or was it reaping? He'll probably say, I told you so. Well, no, she's here by herself and parked under the oak tree that she remembers well, alongside her father's rusty old station wagon. Expecting a stormy reception, she's glad that she left young Toby behind with her boyfriend, Stanley Nelson. Seeds of her plan had been planted years beforehand. So is it time to plant again, or is it time to harvest? Maybe neither one, but whichever. It's exactly the way she wants it. For now, that is. To Margot's surprise, her mother and father are happy to see her, in the way parents seem to welcome a wayward child, especially years after most hard feelings have dissipated. They aren't surprised when Margot tells them that she's unmarried yet has a baby. During the so-so homecoming, she discovers that she has missed the country lifestyle. By morning, Saturday, October 10th, 1992, she finds herself in the hayloft of the barn, swinging on the old hayfork rope, reminiscing, imagining herself as a horse rancher. Gazing out the hayloft door, high above the ground, she sees visions of herself riding across the South 40 on a powerful stallion. From her vantage point, she stares across the fallow fields, reliving an old desire to turn that idle dairy farm into a first-class horse ranch. She instantaneously makes up her mind. The farm is destined to be mine. She calls her best friend, Maria Richardson, who almost immediately shows up with two horses, saddled and ready to ride. Renewal of their past friendship is automatic as they revive old horse ranching plans, all to take place on this farm still owned by Margot's parents. That night, the two old friends go out, crash a music jam, then shark pool games at the corner bar. The two of them skunk a young man named Martin Martle to a crowd of cheering onlookers. The young woman relished the look of panic in Martle's eyes when he realized that his female opponents will run the table. Martle complains that the money he lost isn't his, that it belongs to some other guy who will kill him for losing it. When the Martle kid leaves the bar in fear of his life, the two girls laugh, scoffing at his fears and pocketing their cash, feeling satisfied that they haven't lost their touch. Neither knows that Martle will disappear before morning. The next day, a sunny Sunday, the two friends ride horseback on their cross-country trails. Near the end of the day, after skinny dipping at a remote swimming hole, it's time for Maria to go. On her way home, she drops Margot off at the far corner of the Toro farm. Margot walks across her father's fields, dreaming of what her future holds, but not imagining how her friend Maria will never make it home, only as far as an obscure forest road on the county line.
This is author Phil P.G. Knutson, and he was just reading from Speed Trap Murder, Margot's Manic Dream. We learned that's Margot's dream, is to have a horse ranch. That's all she ever wanted, was to have a horse ranch. We learned some of the characters that are going to appear, and we don't know why we will remember Maria's name or Martin's name, these names that come up. So what about these characters that we are introduced to in the prologue?
Well, it's the prologue in this particular book is kind of like a first chapter one, giving you the background instead of having a flashback and doing it later like many books are written. Many books you get into the story and then there's a flashback. This gives you the backstory immediately because as you read the book, you'll notice the story gets complicated. And it's good to understand at the outset what we're dealing with here and how it was that she was in the situation that she's in.
So she's called a wayward child, but the wayward child comes home to where she doesn't know, oh, when my parents gonna... She's uncertain, to say the least. So let's look at chapter one then, and we meet another character in the book.
Yes, this is a very interesting character in the book. He's an elderly gentleman. Would you just get right into
the
chapter?
I like him. I like the sheriff.
Well, I do too. And maybe you can tell when I lead off here. In this particular book, I've given each chapter a title. Mm-hmm. It helps a reader in going back, and because some reader may want to go back and read something again and can remember that maybe it was in the chapter called The Ominous Phone Call.
Well, for example, I mentioned The Strawberry Moon, and it's in chapter 71. That's the title of chapter 71. So if I want to look back about that, I can flip back to...
That's one of the reasons I gave titles. In many books, it did not have a title on a chapter, but in this particular book, it really helps because...
I agree. Okay, let's hear chapter one.
Okay. It was a quiet Sunday night at the Justice County Sheriff's Office, except for loud snoring coming from the office with a view. The telephone rang, startling the elderly sheriff, a peaceful man named Homer Anders. He bounded to his feet, chair wheels screeching, rolling away from the desk. Loose papers drifted to the floor. A bit disoriented, he felt like his head was still resting on a pillow of unopened mail. He glanced to the switchboard, noticing that line one was flashing. Frustrated that the dispatcher had taken the night off, he made his way to pick up the phone. Doggone it, he lamented. It was peaceful around here until someone had to disturb a perfectly good work-related dream. Before he could say hello, a blood-curdling scream blasted from the earpiece. Then static, obscuring an incomprehensible voice. He guessed that the scratchy-sounding call was originating from a remote location on the fringe of wireless reception. "Try to find a better cell," he said, offering advice to the anonymous caller, straining to hear the broken-up words. He distinguished a few. "Emergency," "bloody," and something about a big swamp. Then a dead line, not even a click. The ensuing dial tone droned while Homer Anders pondered the only audible words, hoping he could figure it out. "Swamp. There's only one big one," he said, thinking out loud of the vast forested bog that was part of the great boreal forest type that extends into the United States from Canada. He knew that area well, the terrain, timber, and sphagnum bogs, since his youth when his grandfather introduced him to hunting and fishing. Access was limited except for a few skid trails, ice roads as the old-timers spoke of them. He panned his finger across the mosaic of black and white area photographs that hung on the wall, looking for familiar details, stopping at the edge of Wilderness Swamp. County Line Road, the only way in, he quickly surmised. Emergency? Oh, this is going to tick me off if it's an early Halloween prank. He radioed the only officer on duty that night, Deputy Clarence Smith. With an all-business 10-4, they arranged to meet on a logging spur just off the county line. Tires rolled immediately. Sheriff Anders wore his Western-style hat as he felt naked without it. The full moon was already high in the sky, the vibes unsettling. "A fine night for the crazies to come out of the woodwork," he said, turning left at the only traffic light in Burntwood Prairie. An autumn chill bit at the late-night air, prompting him to roll up the windows on his cruiser. Heading north into the wilds of northern Minnesota, the sleepy sheriff spun the dial on the dashboard, hoping for AM skip that would bring in some lively music from far away, maybe in Nashville. Entertainment that would keep his eyes open. Curiously, he stopped the knob at a signal from Chicago, attracted by political talk. An encore broadcast of that evening's three-way presidential debate between the entrepreneur Ross Perot, the relatively unknown Arkansas Governor William J. Clinton, and sitting President George H.W. Bush. He listened as he sped through the incipient fog that hovered above the asphalt. The timely political broadcast was of special interest to Homer Anders. The presidential debate kept him alert as he deadheaded to the scene of the alleged crime. He seemed more interested in the upcoming presidential election than in his own reelection bid. Who is this amazing politician, this Clinton, Homer mused out loud as he rubbed his sleep-starved eyes, listening to the debating candidates. He searched through wisp of fog for glimpses of the white dashed line on the blacktop, fast disappearing, then appearing again just below the fog line. He's kicking that Bush. Poor old George. Kind of like the guy, but he'll probably get squeezed out of the whole deal between this new guy, Clinton, and Ross Perot, the third-party spoiler. Homer cracked his smile, then chuckled with a certain admiration for the new guy, William Clinton. He liked the way that candidate Clinton preferred to break away from tradition by only using his nickname, Bill.
This is my guest, Phil Knutson. He's writing under P.G. Knutson, and he just read from Speed Trap Murder, Margot's Manic Dream. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Phil Knutson. He's a local author who's written a mystery, Speed Trap Murder. And in this chapter one, we meet this nice, I think, sheriff. And we also meet another guy we don't know much about, but a deputy. And maybe we don't pay particular attention to his name in chapter one. But we'll need to remember that name later. And that's the interesting thing about mysteries is we don't always know when we start reading mystery what information is going to turn up to be critical.
Well, in a mystery, there's usually a little twist or a turn somewhere.
Yes.
And that's what attracts mystery lovers to want to read a mystery.
That's right.
It's the entertainment value, especially the reading of it. You can watch one on TV and you get almost the same thing. It's a little different when you actually read the story. You have the chance to put the book down and come back. You think about it, and then you come back. I gotta know what happens next.
Well, this made me think of the TV series Columbo, because in that TV series, you know who done it from the very beginning. But Columbo has to figure out, get the clues, get the information, the evidence to prove who done it. And in your book, well, we think we know who done it. And is this person going to get caught? So let's take a look.
Well, there is some intrigue.
Yes, there definitely is some intrigue. So let's take a look at chapter two.
Okay, the title of this chapter is The Yellow-Haired Girl. And you remember the sheriff was just on his way to the scene of the crime.
Yes.
It was almost midnight when Sheriff Anders arrived at the remote meeting place on the south edge of Wilderness Swamp. Deputy Smith was already parked on the loose gravel, seated in his patrol car, headlights on high beam, with the heater running. His spotlight was aimed across the ditch into the dense timber, casting a beam of bright light far into the popples. Sheriff Anders parked alongside Smith's patrol car, stopping just behind an occupied horse trailer, still attached to a farm pickup truck.
A horse trailer.
Yeah, we ran into that already, didn't we?
What does that have to do with the story?
Well, let's see here. The sheriff stepped out of his car, glancing at puffs of his own breath that had instantly condensed into a billowing fog, quickly rising in the frigid air. The sky was in motion, crisscrossed with eerie beams of vertical lights, green and red, undulating above the treetops and high into the black but starlit sky. They were wavering back and forth like a collection of searchlights searching for a lost soul somewhere in the great beyond. "Invigorating," Homer said boldly, shaking off the heebie-jeebies, as the moonlight was downright spooky that night, especially combined with the undulating ribbons of colored lights directly above. He was stretching stiffness from his arms when Deputy Smith approached. "Weird ionosphere. Electrical force is going nuts," Smith remarked. "Well, I've always liked the Northern Lights," Anders said. "Intellectually stimulating, although a bit extreme tonight." "Well, my wife, the purist, would kill me if I didn't use the scientific term Aurora Borealis," the deputy said. Small talk instead of a greeting. "Is the caller here?" Anders asked, glancing all about but not seeing anyone. "Who?" "Well, the caller, of course. The person who called in the emergency." Poor reception had to be on one of those newfangled cellular telephones where you can't understand anything. Deputy Smith almost laughed. "Don't you love those portable antenna jobs?" "I'd expect that the caller, after going through the trouble to make the call, would have at least shown up. Who'd make such a call if it was a legitimate emergency, then go into hiding?" He angled his thumb at the truck and trailer. "Whose rig is this?" There was a reverberant murmur from a horse inside the trailer. Deputy Smith shrugged his shoulders. "So, what's up, Clarence?" the sheriff doubtfully asked, thinking that the deputy himself, the office jokester, may have been the one who spoofed that call. "Well, it's a shocker. Come and see for yourself." Sheriff Anders followed his deputy into the edge of the woods. The patrol car spotlighted his back. Suspicious that co-pranksters from the office had led him to this obscure place in the middle of the night to participate as a sucker in some hilarious Halloween prank, Homer stayed alert. He expected to hear a spurt of laughter or Halloween hoots emitting from the dark shadows. He was accustomed to going along with a limited amount of nonsense, hoping his staff would get their kicks over with and that everyone could get back to work. After following Smith for a short distance, Homer slowed his steps to a stop. Not seeing anything unusual and seeming confused as to the purpose of this late-night trek into the forest, he asked, "Deputy Smith, what's going on? A snipe hunt?" Clarence laughed at that, then pointed with his flashlight, a lifeless form almost hidden among the ferns, pale skin and a splash of blood shown in the center of the light beam. "I told you, boss, it's a shocker. This girl has been murdered." "No, not in my county," cried Homer Anders, seeing the yellow-haired girl lying on fresh-fallen leaves. Breathless, he stared at the dead blonde's face, hoping she was not someone that he knew. She was not. Beautiful hair, like new corn silks.
This is my guest, Phil Knutson. He writes under P.G. Knutson, but people in the area. He's a local writer. We know him as Phil Knutson. He was reading from Speed Trap Murder, Margot's Manic Dream. And you give us hints as to what's going on at this time in the United States. For example, you tell us it's 1992. The previous chapter, we hear, oh, Bill Clinton's running. This is when he first ran. And Ross Perot, remember him? And he's talking about cell phones just coming into use. So you give us clues to kind of put us back in 1992.
Yes, we're going back. A little throwback is a good thing. It helps us remember. We can remember when we could hardly make our cell phones function.
Well, I even remember it because my husband and I happened to be making a trek into the Ozark Mountains in Arkansas, and there was happened to be a parade. We stopped in this town. There was a parade, and there were convertibles, and this person was in this convertible, and he was in the parade and waving, and I thought, who is that young kid? I said, oh, that's our governor. It was Bill Clinton. He looked like a kid. He was so young then. Reading that took me back quite a few years myself. So we get some more information because October, too, you'd think, oh, well, they're pulling a Halloween stunt. They're trying to make the sheriff go out into the country for no reason. And then they find the body. Oh, my goodness. Well, why don't we skip over to Chapter 5 and meet a couple more characters, and we learn that Margot gets a job. So would you read a little bit of Chapter 5?
Okay, we can do that. This chapter is titled Secret Swimming Hole. The winter was typically cold until February when an unexpected thaw began. All this time, Henry and Betty Torloff never heard from Margot. But with the promise of an early spring, the changing future began to roll out quickly. Out of the blue, their daughter landed a nursing job in Burntwood Prairie. This miracle, finding employment with an easy commuting distance of her home place, gave rise to the resurfacing of her childhood aspirations of having her own horse ranch. Ecstatic, she abruptly returned to the farm, announcing that she was moving in. She introduced Toby to her parents, then took over her old bedroom. The place was full of her childhood memories. It still held the same magic. It provided the place of solace that she craved. She was done with that big city life. By mid-March, a wintry blanket of accumulated snow had succumbed to the daily onslaught of 50-degree warmth. The fields became bare, runoff trickled, and the ditches overflowed. The weekend finally came when Stanley Nelson drove up to the farm.
Let me pause for just a second. She mentions the name Toby, and if people remember Toby, she has a son. Toby's the name of her son. And then when the weekend came, Stanley Nelson drove up to the farm. And Stanley was not her husband, but the father of Toby, her son. Okay.
That's right. So it's his first time to be up there.
Yeah, so, okay, so now we're meeting Stanley.
Okay, well, Margot was excited to show him around. Her secret swimming hole was the first stop, but the water was high. No matter, Willow Creek commonly overflowed its banks. She looked up at the knot at the end of the rope, far out on the oak limb where it was tied. She tried not to think about Maria Richardson, who had been killed only hours after the two of them had last swung on that rope. More than 5 months had gone by, yet the memory was fresh in her mind. Maria did this so well, Margot whispered, wanting to remember the good times but none of the sadness. She braced her foot against an exposed root and glanced over the rushing clay-colored waters. Unconcerned that the creek had risen to a dangerous flood stage level. The rope felt thick in her hand. She remembered how it took both hands to grip it fully years before when she was a little girl. She snuck a glance at Stanley Nelson, who stood off to the side. Stanley wore a spring jacket and blue jeans with no intention of jumping in. He watched from the riverbank, absorbing her ever-present magical aura that always lured him in. He adored her. Her form perfect, beautiful. Even from a distance, she looked like a calendar girl. His eyes couldn't stray as she was poised to plunge into the eddy pond that swirled below. Knowing that Stanley was watching gave her a special feeling of excitement. She wanted him to be impressed with her daring stunt, something she had done many times in the past. "Take one last look," she called out flirtatiously. Margot knew that she looked sexy in her cut-off jeans and white T-shirt, and that she had just shown enough charisma to make any man look twice. She tightened her grip, glanced at Stanley once more, and cried out a hoot.
This is Phil Knutson, local author, reading from Speed Trap Murder, Margot's Manic Dream. And it comes up again in what you just read, her childhood aspirations of having her own horse ranch. After a break, Phil Knutson and I will continue our conversation. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, local author Phil Knutson, who had studied natural sciences, and he's written a book, Speed Trap Murder. Another character we really like. I really like Stanley. I think readers will like him. Margot, not so sure. But anything else you want to add to this chapter 5, The Secret Swimming Hole?
Well, as the story continues, she does take that plunge into the swollen stream, and the water's cold, and when she goes under, she doesn't come up right away, and Stanley actually panics, running along the bank, and his heart is, you know, pattering very hard.
But she does come up.
She does, but he did have his fears that something happened.
Yeah, well, I would think he would.
But when she bursts through the surface of the water, she calls out something to him, and he was relieved that she was okay because she had just gone through many months of gloom after death of her friend.
Yeah, Maria, yeah. Well, now I'm going to skip to chapter 35, and the title of this chapter, The Maternity Ward. Now, what's a maternity ward, Bill?
Well, we're going to soon find out.
Well, we think, well, it must be humans having babies.
Well,
in this chapter 2, also chapter 35, we meet another character. His name is Charlie Day. And let's see what role Charlie Day plays in the story. Why don't you read us a little bit from chapter 35?
Okay. Cut Across Road was the fastest way to Charlie Day's ranch. In a western mood, Margot drummed her fingers on the steering wheel and harmonized with George Strait on the radio. The equestrian ranch style that she had always wanted, the fruition of her lifetime dream, was only hours away. She could feel it coming, and just the thought of it gave her goosebumps. The herd of yearlings rushed to peer over the top of the fence when Margot turned in. Feathers of the dreamcatcher danced wildly in the stiff breeze, giving her the feeling of protection from bad dreams. She loved the idea of that.
By the way, for people who aren't familiar with the dreamcatcher, this is the Native Americans, the Great Plains, believe that the air is filled with both good and bad dreams. And according to the legend, the good dreams pass through this center hole to the sleeping person. The bad dreams are trapped in the web, where they perish in the light of dawn. And so people would hang these dream catchers. And I'll bet a lot of listeners actually have a dream catcher. I have a friend who has several of them. And so feathers of the dream catcher are blowing in the breeze. And let's continue there.
Yeah. Yeah, so she loved the idea of that, the Indian tradition. Mr. Day was pitching hay into a round pen, but he was not alone. He was talking with two black-haired young men while working. One man was wearing a black business suit, not expected in a place where manure meets shovel. "Hey, y'all made it," Mr. Day called out when he saw Margot approaching. The two younger men left immediately without saying anything to her. "I told you I was coming," Margot said, noticing that Mr. Day bore a worrisome expression in spite of his polite greeting. She glanced at the departing men and asked, "Is something wrong? Did I interrupt you? Something important?" No, just tribal business. We're in federal court right now. Many tribes, actually, trying to get our treaty rights restored. They were systematically stolen from us, never truly recognized. Old history, but at the time, nothing seemed more important than westward expansion. "I don't get it," she said. "If you win, does this mean that Native Americans will finally be able to hunt and fish without being arrested?" "Well, if the judge will listen and order the government to recognize the Treaty of 1837 and the Treaty of 1854 is valid, even today, more than a century and a half later, everyone will soon understand."
So this chapter, and this is from the book Speed Trap Murder, by Phil Knutson, a local author, we meet this Native American who gives some of the history of his people, that he's hoping that Native Americans will finally be able to hunt and fish without being arrested.
In many states in the United States, the game laws, the hunting and fishing laws, worked against the Indians, and that's why they took the federal government to court to stop the states from imposing laws upon them. Because in the treaties, the Indians were given perpetual rights for gathering food off the forest or wherever, gathering rice out of the streams and fish, and living off the land, basically. And over a period of time after those treaties were signed, it was like the treaties had been forgotten. And in society, it is just well known that if you fish out of season or without a fishing license, you are in trouble. And the Indians, of course, never liked this, and they finally took the government to court. It would have been 1993 at this time. And, of course, we find out later that they actually won in court, and they got those rights have been restored.
Well, you know, I think reading this about the dream catcher has inspired me. I have a dream catcher. It's brand new. In fact, I got it the day before I read this in your book about the dream catcher.
That's amazing.
Quite a coincidence. Thinking, I think I'll hang a dream catcher somewhere in my house. So anyway, we get to meet this nice character, and he has horses. And at one point he jokes, we call this the maternity ward, because the new arrivals would be what?
Well, it was the folding barn, unless they're just born out in the pasture, which happens too. But he was managing his herd, and when the pregnant mares came to the right time, he would usher them into his maternity ward, and he'd take special care of them, and in a place where he could do it rather than just out on the grass.
And this was certainly of interest to Margot, because that's what she wanted. She wanted one of those little babies.
That's exactly right.
Well, we spend chapter 35 on Charlie Day's ranch, where he's growing horses and his horses are having little foals. So now let's skip over to chapter 37. And I'd like you to read a little bit of chapter 37, Phil.
Okay. This title on this chapter is Old Indian Friend. And here she's showing up at the farm with her first horse she bought. So here's her parents.
Mark Munn, listeners, that Hank is her dad. Her name Henry is called Hank. So this is Margot's dad, Hank, speaking now.
She's back, Hank announced, recognizing Charlie Day's homemade doodle bug pickup truck, pulling a small horse trailer and turning by the mailbox. But we're not done yet, Betty said. She should have done this herself. Who has extra time to spend on her hobby? I should be cooking supper. Company coming tonight, too. Margot can pitch in. No reason she can't help in the kitchen. She owes Ernie big time. And digging her pond ain't the half of it. Your spaghetti done up right on Mom's old cook stove should be the magic formula needed. Old flames might reignite. Maybe a spark left. One problem, she's not coming. Not with Ernie here, Betty said woefully. This stubborn streak of hers. She hates him. At least that's what she says. Well, she says she's getting married to Stanley, too, but don't hold your breath, Henry. There's something wrong with that situation. You're telling me. Margot parked in her space and ran for the barn, motioning to Charlie to turn in that direction. She proceeded to direct his backing of the trailer next to the spot where Hank was setting a wood post. Betty stepped out of the way. Wait till you see her. She's beautiful, Margot said. Watching the slowly backing trailer, she raised her hand in the air, shouting to Charlie, hold her there.
Okay, so here's this. When Margot says she's beautiful, she's referring to this little newborn colt. And that's going to be her horse. Margot might just realize her dream. And we don't know. Because you don't tell us.
Well, she is taking delivery of a pregnant mare.
Mm-hmm.
And the foal could just come at any time. So that everyone's excited on the farm.
Well, so that's one. Her parents are saying, she's going to get married to Stanley. And then her dad says, well, don't hold your breath. I'm not sure about that. So that's one mystery. Are Stanley and Margot going to get married? So that's one mystery.
Well, we don't know that at this point.
No, we don't.
It looks a little shaky.
That's what the parents say. Another mystery is in the title, Speed Trap Murder. Speed Trap Murder. Now, we don't want to spoil the fun, Phil. You don't want to give away too much.
No, that segment is coming shortly.
So we already encountered one body. And Sheriff Homer went out to look at and discovers this body. He thought it was a Halloween prank, but nope, actually there's a body there. But that's only the first body.
That's right.
And in the title, Speed Trap Murder, we think, oh, here's a murder.
It does bring something else to mind in most people's mind.
The Speed Trap Murder?
Yes.
And you want to say any more about that?
Well, it's coming ahead. I don't know if I'll be reading it in that section or not, but it gets into the more complicated part of the story.
Yeah, and so we have to keep the character straight, and some of the characters that are kind of mentioned in passing reappear and play more of a role than we anticipated. So anything else you want to tell us we don't want to give away too much here, Phil. Anything else you want to tell listeners before we conclude our mystery?
Well, I hope everyone will be curious enough to get their hands on a copy of this book and read it.
Well, people do like mysteries and thrillers. I have a lot of friends that, that's their favorite genre. But this one, I even enjoyed this one. Because every time I turned the page, I thought, I didn't expect that. And usually you like the main character, and I couldn't really decide, do I like Margot or not? Because she wasn't very nice to Stanley. Stanley was a dear guy. I loved him. But sometimes she wasn't very nice to him.
Well, there are more aspects to the story. Somewhere in the story we'll learn that country music and bluegrass music play a large role in the book, yet the portion's yet to come.
Yes.
And Margot is an extremely talented woman.
Yes. We didn't know that about her in the beginning.
Well, we learn a little bit at a time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I didn't put it all on page one.
You know what, though? And I wouldn't want to go to the very end of what happens, but when I was reading your book, I was almost at the last page, and a neighbor happened to walk by and said, I saw my grass needed mowing. And he said, would you like me to mow your grass? Well, of course I did. He was so nice of him. And so then I read this last sentence in your book, neighbors helping neighbors. That's a wonderful way to conclude our talk, I think, Phil. Neighbors helping neighbors.
It is. It brings the story to an end in knowing that there's more for their future.
Yeah, yeah. But then when I closed your book and looked out at my lawn and said, yes, my dear neighbor helped me. He was so nice to mow my lawn for me.
Well, the follow-up to this book will be a second book with some of these same characters.
Oh, good.
And the story will continue with some of your favorite characters.
Oh, we'll look forward to that, Phil. My guest has been local author Phil P.J. Knutson, and the title of this book, Speed Trap Murder, Margot's Manic Dream. Thank you, Phil.
You're welcome.
And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
The Treehouse. I thought that house would never change. 2 decades ago, we sold it. New owners changed the house and land. The deed was signed and folded. The treehouse we built took summer's light. Seams fitted with nary a crack. Level floors, sloped roof, and branches pruned. In time, it would all grow back. The three brothers, all of them, worked in the cold and the hot. My promise, not to meddle. We moved to a place with waiting trees, a place for all of us to settle. They planned a treehouse in the new strong limbs. Would use muscle, their plans, and grit. The brothers grew with independent thoughts, and in the treehouse they could sit. The brothers aged with kids of their own. In the treehouse their kids now play. The brothers' pride, they work so hard, as I promised, I stayed away. And now they've grown, and great dads they are. I hear laughter and things that they yell. Remember when we made our first treehouse? The whispers we heard will never tell. Many abandoned long ago, they built one of their own, a private place for kids to go when they're young and when they've grown. It's someone else's turn to build a treehouse that lasts for years. I watched them carefully from window's view and wiped away the tears. A special place for kids to play, to go and talk and sit. And the biggest growth you will ever see is the muscle, the love, and the grit. Mark Mallinger.
Missing it. Staring into the distance, my ears were silenced and my eyes blind to the twinkling of light from the water jumping from stone to rock and the showy red head of the woodpecker as it bounced against the wooden pantry door. The pine tree deadened to its beak and the breakdown of its once noble life. The reflection of the tiger lily roared orange against the blue sky and the otherwise passive water at the edge of the stream. If the trout had not jumped, if the crow had not objected, if the rabbit had not ruffled the feathers of the bush, I would have missed it all. Julie Horn.
Tender golden gratitude. I'm still seeking better touching gratitude. In that true, after many distant tryings and so much missing, by myself with others. Not any makeup, not Sunday school. Genuine, sincere, bringing me upwards on a long, dried topic. Yes, please. So I seek finer frequencies in me, for me, tuning in gratitude. And we begin, gratitude and I, sending subtle frequencies to each other, softly, unmistakable. The melody is elusive, but it is still there, clearer, the more I tune true. I tune better, vibrant colors, soft touchings, sweet tastes, magic fragrances. Then come those feelings, strong ones, powerful, dominating, gentle ones, sweet carings, kindness. Fun play with gratitude. Who would have imagined? Then sparkling gratitude, so bright. And along the way, I find tender, golden gratitude. And I write this. Now I read. I'm embarrassed. Does this work for you? It's a relationship. Gratitude rebounds to us always, to my reachings and to tuned in touchings. It rebounds back to me. It flows softly, not to overwhelm, circling me. Speechless, I can say no more. Tender Golden Gratitude by Les Haight.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
Listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.